Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Greetings, beautiful mutants. This is Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo with you here on Consequence, and we're going to take apart Girl You Want.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. In this very special episode, I interview Mark Mothersbaugh, singer, keyboardist, and songwriter of one of the most iconic bands of all time, Devo. I've always been a fan of the band's artistry and overall zeitgeist, and I'm grateful to have developed a relationship with both Mark and fellow Spud Boy Jerry Casale, whom I interviewed back in season one. You can revisit that interview with Jerry giving the story behind Whip It in the Story Behind the Song Vault. But this time it's Mark's turn, and we discuss the story behind another classic track from the 1980 album Freedom of Choice. A song that was inspired both by a magazine cover he saw as he window shopped on tour and by the Knack's own knockout track, My Sharona. And that song is Girl You Want. Mark is more than an artist. He's a true Renaissance man and conceptualist, a word that he feels best describes his approach to his art and to his life. And he paints on an expansive canvas. His art with Devo takes the form of deeply idiosyncratic music that is tinged with an ironic dose of tech. And thankfully, Devo continues its 50 years of de-evolution continued tour throughout this year, because if ever there were a de-evolutionary time that demands Devo, well, we surely are in it now. But beyond Devo, Mark is one of the film and television industry's leading composers, and he's also a visual artist of great range who will open up his LA art gallery for all of us to see later this year. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind Devo's bouncing, boisterous track, Girl You Want, with singer, keyboardist, songwriter, and all-around conceptualist, Mark Mothersbaugh. More than anything, Mark, and you and I have talked before several times, but you're a conceptualist. You're involved in deeply in visual arts, movies, television series, video games, and there's so much more. And so I have to ask you first, how do you find the time?
You can ask my wife. She can tell you we never go to parties hardly. We're like, she can't believe it. She feels I'm the most boring person. But I don't know. I've got enough. I don't know. It keeps me from getting in trouble if I'm always doing a little bit of work on things. And so it's just the way it's always been.
I assume you're in your offices on Sunset Boulevard today.
Yep.
That's that fluorescent green building that is just iconic. And Mark, what was that before you bought the place?
In 1969, it was built by a plastic surgeon. And it had, it was this round building. He was kind of obsessed with round buildings, apparently. He commissioned a famous architect, Oscar Niemeyer, who designed designed like the UN building, and he designed Brasilia, the city, in sort of a circular pattern. Even if you ever saw what Brasilia looks like, it's like all the streets are circular, with the government in the very middle. It's kind of cool, but it used to be in the 70s. Women came in here and they went to one of the little side rooms around the edges and they fell asleep, and and woke up with smaller noses and bigger boobs. And that's what this place was for a long time. And then it kind of just, it changed hands, but nothing of any consequence, really. And I had been driving down from Laurel Canyon down into West Hollywood on the way to rehearse with Devo out in Marina Del Rey. And every day I'd get down to the bottom of the hill and I'd see this ugly putty-colored building with gold windows, and it was always for sale for like about 5 or 6 years, and it would go into escrow and then it would fall out, and it was always because there wasn't enough parking for people that wanted to have a restaurant or something. So
yeah,
that's what happened. And then I kept saying, you know, it would save me 2 hours of driving. I could spend 2 more hours writing music if we were, you know, working out of this building instead of way out in Mar Vista or wherever we were. And so I got enough pennies together, I could get the down payment. And at the end of year one, I was still in the black. So I was like, okay, this is it. So, and I painted it green because it was so ugly, and the coloring on it. And it had these gold metallic reflecting windows, rose gold. They were depressing looking to look at them. I kept painting. I wanted to take them out, and then, well, that'll be $80,000 to replace all the glass. I didn't have enough money to do that. So I just kept painting the back wall different colors until I found a color that neutralized the rose gold, and it was that green color.
Didn't know, but it's on the National List of Historic Buildings, isn't it?
I was trying to keep it off of it, to be honest with you, but I think it is on. I think it's going on because for whatever reason. I wouldn't do anything to hurt it because I love this building. I've been here for 35 years writing music.
That's amazing. I had no idea. I knew it was a historic building, but I didn't know it was Oscar Niemeyer. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, pretty wild, huh?
Well, which is a perfect home for you, given the fact that you're such a visual artist and do so many different things. And before we get into the music, you've showed me this in your office before. You've showed me all your postcards, your postcard art. You have books and books of postcards. Can you describe to everybody just your journey to become a musician? Not Devo initially, but just as an artist, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay. I'll try and make it as quick as I can. When I was seven, it was the last month of second grade, and I'd been through first and second grade. Teachers had decided I was kind of like an a-hole because they'd say things like, all right, Mark, add up the numbers on the board. And I'd go, what's a board? And all the other kids would laugh, and I'd go, how do they know the right answer? You know, and then just about the end of the school year, the teacher who had been spanking me, because this was the 50s, so they were allowed to do that back then, man. So she like said, hey, did you ever get your child's eyes checked? And my parents went, well, no, we got 5 kids. We never did that. And they found out I was legally blind.
Wow.
So I spent the first 2 years going to elementary school. I just walked, and I could see enough to see what a sidewalk was. And I knew that if I walked here, then I'd cross the street. And luckily, I made it 2 years without getting hit by a car before I got a pair of glasses. And when I did, it was like my whole life changed. And I saw the sun, clouds, the roof of a house, treetops, birds flying. I'd never seen any of that stuff before, and I was like, this is amazing. And so I started drawing things, and there was a tree in my front yard that I only knew the part that I ran into when I was playing, and I'd never seen what it looked like up at the top. And so I was drawing this tree, and this teacher who had been spanking me all year was watching, and she goes, you draw trees better than me. And that was the first nice thing she'd ever said. And I remember I went home that night and dreamt I was going to be an artist. So I knew when I was seven I was going to be an artist. And then I didn't know what that meant, but I was totally convinced of it. And then 13, my dad used to set a little portable black and white TV on the table so that the 5 kids would shut up and watch TV during dinner. I remember one night Ed Sullivan came on and said, okay, from Liverpool, it's the Beatles. And I saw the Beatles and I went, that's why they made me learn how to play an organ, which I never wanted to learn how to play because my parents, oh, maybe someday he'll play in church, you know. And So, and then I'd learn like stuff like ebb tide, you know, or autumn leaves or something, you know, all these horrible like songs that I hated. And I'd try to play as loud and as slow as I could when Mrs. Fox, my organ teacher, was over, because my parents and family were in the next room trying to watch TV, and I'd play really loud, and she sang along with it. So it's like, you know, she out of tune. She was really out of tune. So it'd be like, the autumn leaves. I'd like get even louder so that she'd say, then they'd turn the TV up louder, and they'd all get closer to it. And my friends would walk by the window while I was practicing, and they'd be like holding up a football laughing or something, or and I'd be like, you know, just giving them the finger out the window. And I had to, so, but then I realized that's why I had spent my whole life being tortured learning how to play music. I didn't even want to play music. And then when I saw the Beatles, that made me want to play music. So it's like 13, I was an artist that was going to be in a band no matter what. And then things kept devolving from there.
What was your first band?
Gosh, it was some band that I had pestered my parents for like a couple years to let me get a portable organ. And like there was one like the one that Ray Manzarek from The Doors used. It was a Farfisa Italian company. So I'm doing research trying to figure out where do you find a Farfisa organ in Akron, Ohio? And it was at an accordion shop. They had one of them. They had this one, and it was only a couple $100. It was cheap, but it still took a couple years to get them to get it for me. And then, so while I was there buying the organ, they said, and we put together bands here. So this accordion teacher, he also put together like rock bands. So he'd pull in like a couple kids that would be playing Galanti guitars, and they'd have the Italian guitar, I'd have the Italian organ, and we'd sit in Saturdays, we'd go and we'd learn how to play Walk Don't Run and things like that, you know, like stuff that was easy. We called the band, I don't know why we called it the Shags. I think it was because of haircuts, but we weren't the famous girl band called the Shags. It was like about a few years later, but we were some unknown band called the Shags, and that was my first band.
Well, how about that? So the musical journey for you for forming a band was introduced by an accordion teacher. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and we ignored him as much as anything else because we really just needed a place all to get together and play that stuff. And those guys were like, they had sheet music for what was the name of that band that played Wipeout and all, Kingsman? Or no, not
yeah,
the Kingsman. Not
think,
the Kingsman.
I think it was.
No, Kingsman did Louie Louie.
Oh,
was
that's
like,
right. That's
I forget right. their band. Well, it doesn't matter, but he had sheet music, and so they'd be sitting there reading sheet music, and I'd have like block chords, and I'd be going, dun, 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 dun. That was the first band. I mean, but I knew the goal was to be like a British invasion band. And I followed the British invasion when I was a kid. I remember being really, I couldn't afford to buy a Tiger Beat magazine, but I would go read it every 2 weeks or every month whenever it came out. And I remember the month it came out, and there was a picture on the cover. It said, Beatles versus Dave Clark 5, who will win? And I remember I was such a Beatles fan, I was all night I couldn't sleep because I was worried, because I'm like, the Dave Clark 5, they've got 5 and Beatles only have 4. It's not fair. That's not fair. I remember I was really worried about that. I didn't know what it meant, a battle of the bands, but
yeah.
I mean, I imagine them being in a fist fight or something.
Right.
It was actually then when I was in high school that I met a jazz teacher. I would go study with him, and he taught me improv and, you know, like tonic root, you know, chord progressions and jazz, which really applied to like writing music and to writing, you know, like rock and roll, or which is what I thought I wanted to do back then. And he was super cool because he had like orange skin between his ring finger and his middle finger from holding a cigarette there while he played jazz music in nightclubs. And so I thought he was cool. And then after that, it was just I was on my own. I would take and slow down I'd take a 45, and if it was had an organ part on it, like a complicated one, like Light My Fire, the din 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 din, I'd slow it down to 33, and I'd learn it at 33, and then I'd push it up to 45 and change the whatever key it would change to. I learned how to play it fast then.
Yeah, and then obviously then you went into college, and that's where you met Gerald Casale, and everything changed.
Everything changed. Yeah, I went to college. I went in as a visual artist because I could get a partial scholarship for that, and I just so I got a night job so I could pay the rest of it off, and then it kept me out of Vietnam basically because I couldn't think of a single Asian person I wanted to kill, and so I thought, well, I'd be terrible over there. I wouldn't be any help at all to the U.S. Army. So I got into college, and it gave me an S2. A student deferment from being draftable. The first year I was at college, I took a, I don't know, I just signed up for art classes, you know, because I didn't think that music would be, I didn't think reading sheet music would ever be helpful in my life. I thought, you know, I've never seen a picture of like the Rolling Stones sitting around with sheet music or the Doors sitting around, or Jimi Hendrix like writing out his solo on sheet music. So I thought I don't want to take any of the college classes for music. And unfortunately, I didn't, because as it turned out in my career, I could have used that. I had to learn on the job how to read. But I got into printmaking, and printmaking I thought was the most high tech thing you could do as an artist. I thought that was like, because there weren't computers yet that were artist friendly or artist usable yet. That didn't have, they just had computers with black screens and green type, you know, that school teachers and business people used. It was nothing like what it is now.
Yeah.
But I got into printmaking. I started making things on stickers and decals so that I could, because I'd wait for like school to be out. It'd be out at 3:30 in the afternoon, and all these kids would run off to that were in like sorority houses or fraternity houses, or they'd just go to the bar or whatever kids did after class.
And this was at Kent State University.
Kent State, yeah, 1969.
Yeah.
1968. And so it became, it's like I had the whole art building to myself. Nobody else was there. They all left. So I could go burn a screen, print it, print a color, and then go wash the screen out, burn it again with another color, come back and print that color, and you know, after four times you'd have a four color piece of art, you know, 50 of them or however many I'd make. And then I was so excited when I made these decals and stickers at 3 a.m. on the way back to my car so I could drive back to farmland where I lived. I'd be putting them up on stop signs and on, you know, fire hydrants and things, and people's bumpers sometimes, you know, like they'd get a free sticker. I think it was 69. It was still my first year at school. And this guy, Jerry Casale, he was a grad student. And he came in to where I was in some art class, and he goes, "Are you the guy putting up those pictures of astronauts holding potatoes standing on the moon?" And I go, "Yeah, what of it?" And he goes, "What do potatoes mean to you?" And we got into this discussion about potatoes and became instant friends. And he was looking for somebody to help him print some decals, you know, like that I've been doing for his grad student senior thesis project. And so I printed these little potato men that he could then put them on top of photographs of blow-up photographs of kids that he didn't like them as high school, that he had fought with while he was in high school, or didn't get along with. So his senior thesis was pictures out of his high school yearbook blown up, and teachers and other kids he didn't like. He'd hang these green potato men that I was printing for him all over their ears and on their nose or whatever.
Oh, that's classic.
And that's how we started working together. And
so let me ask you about that. Just how, when did you have that sensibility? When did that begin for you where it's you had, as you mentioned it, astronauts and potatoes. And that is, you know, Devo's sensibility obviously is extremely unique, and especially then, and so influential continuing to today. So did you always have this almost like Dada art sensibility to yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I think part of being blind for 7 years, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, it wasn't like, so it was black. You know, so everything was black. Wow. It was like foggy. It's like, you know, when they on the TV, you know, on a news channel, they're showing you something on a cell phone and it's the middle stripe. And then on the two sides, it's blurred out. Or sometimes people do it in Zooms. They blur out the background. That's what I could see. I could see. I knew if it was day or night or light or dark in a room, and I'd see a blob, and I'd hear the sound of a door, and I'd look over and I'd see a blob, and I'd hear a voice, and I'd go, Grandma, because Grandma would be there, and I'd run up and I'd grab her by the face and like be so happy, and I'd be like 3 inches away, and they thought, okay, he's a little too intense, something's wrong with this kid. And but they didn't ever put it together that I couldn't see until, you know, but I think my brain got used to like looking at things that were blobs and blurs and colors and light and dark and turning them into things. I think that's why I never really liked LSD. I had it dropped on me twice, and both times it was horrible experiences because it was so extreme. And talking to people, that I realized that my mind already kind of was, you know, like trained from when I was a little kid to try and make things out of shapes and things on its own. So it was like it was like a little too intense for me to ever do that stuff. So I never did it again. I tried to stay away from it.
You know what's so amazing about that is that it's yet another example where your biggest challenge became your superpower. And it sounds almost cliche, but it's really true. It's that, and I can't even imagine as a young kid, because you didn't know about glasses, you didn't know what you didn't know. So for you, that was just what you felt, probably other people, how they were experiencing life. And so it's just like you said, when you put glasses on for the first time, it completely changed everything, but it became your superpower to be this immensely creative person.
A lot of what people call disabilities are people's superpowers, because it gives them a chance to think outside of the box a little more. Like autistic kids, like whenever I talk to them or meet them, they always seem very interesting. And I always try to encourage people that feel like something's missing, and I'm like, that might be, you might have something extra instead of something missing, you know. It's like, yeah, they tell you you're missing something, but maybe you aren't. Maybe you have something else. And so, I don't know. I'm in kind of an agreement with you on that, you know, about a disability can be flipped into your power.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Girl You Want was from your third studio album, Freedom of Choice.
Yes.
And your first two albums, I want to get into your headspace going into the third album, but it seems like from the outside, fairly immediate success once you got booed off stages from small clubs and things like that. But then there was something that happened. You had your first album, Are We Not Men? You were on SNL for that album. You had several songs that are just iconic songs, and then you had your second album, and then your third album is a very different sound than your first two albums. Your first two albums were much more guitar-driven, and then it switched over to keyboards in 1980 for this album. So what was your headspace? What was behind all of that? And was, because I would imagine it's a conscious choice to flip the sound a little bit.
Yeah, well, first off, all those songs on the first two albums were written back in Ohio. And they were, you know, we played them on stage and worked them out on stage before they went on an album. And so we kind of had preconceived notions of what those records were going to sound like before they happened. With the third album, we started talking about, well, what would a Devo funk album sound like? What would funky Devo be? I mean, you know, you can listen to that record and see it's not all that funky, but, you know, it's like, that's what we were thinking. We were thinking, what would be funky for us? And we wrote that album in Los Angeles. We were at this little tiny rehearsal space, and we, you know, we brought in ideas and put things together. And so it was the first one that was written post signing a record deal and putting out albums. You know, it's like the second album, you know, like I said, it was written in, you know, in Ohio, and it was played on stage before we, and these were like, they just, we were just putting them together in this room. And Girl You Want, what happened with the music is, there was a song that just happened to be out at the time called My Sharona, and I liked the way he was playing the guitar. And I thought, there's something about that, it related to Devo, I thought, in a way, that kind of, I mean, we could play a guitar that way. And so I was playing this thing here, the pattern that became the lead line for Girl You Want, and I don't know, everybody, it sounded good. Everybody was playing it, and they did a good job. They all put in interesting parts. And then the lyrics for it, we'd been on tour, done a couple tours already in both U.S., Europe, and even Asia at that point. And it just happened the year before we were in Europe, and we were playing all over, like, the United Kingdom. And I walked by this, you know, it's like I was just up early and excited because I was in Glasgow. And I'm just walking around the town, and I'd never been there before, and it was so exciting. And Devo had always found religious stores interesting because there were things that we didn't agree on, but that we both supported in a way. Like, for instance, in the 30s, Christianity became really upset with evolution and Darwin, that whole theory, and they made fun of evolution. And there was a guy in Ohio, a pastor, who put out a whole set of pamphlets, and one of them was called Jocko Homo. In it, he was making fun of the idea of man, you know, evolving from apes, and instead, he opened up the cover of this little pamphlet that he had done, and the first picture was a devil with a pitchfork pointing up a set of staircase that had, like, sins of man, you know, and like World War I, World War II, blah, 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 slavery, you know, blah, 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 all these different horrible things that man was responsible for. And this devil had on his chest, it said de-evolution, and it said man after 1 million years or something like that, and had a monkey sitting at his feet gnawing on a bone. You know, we were always looking for anti-evolutionary information. You know, it's like the Christians love to just like fire it out. And so I walked by the store, and there was a pamphlet in the front of the store called Just the Girl You Want. And it was like the image, it was like a blonde-haired girl holding a bag of dog treats, and she's feeding a dog treat to a dog. I thought, oh, I got to check that out.
That is such a non-obvious thing when you say Just the Girl You Want and you have a girl who's feeding dog treats. That is very Devo.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess if you identified with the dog, then, you know, it starts having more meaning. But
yeah.
So anyhow, there was this pamphlet, and there was no lyrics in it that were usable, but it was like, I just loved the cover so much, and like I had these other pamphlets that were religious pamphlets, and I put them in with them, and I started writing, it's kind of like a love song or some sort of, it's like a Devo version of a love song, I guess you would say, and they just fit really well. We were in this little studio. We put them together, and it came out really good. I liked the bass line Jerry made up. was very cool, and that's how the song got started.
So was that a typical process?
Well, I guess it was typical in the sense that, yeah, I had, we had both found books or writings that we like borrowed from or used, like the Jocko Homo, I loved Jocko Homo because at the same time, the Rolling Stones had just put out an album a year or two before called Monkey Man. I mean, there was a song on it called Monkey Man. It was, on the street fighting. Or no, I'm a monkey, monkey. And I thought, well, Monkey Man, that's like a Rolling Stone reference to me, as far as I was, concerned, Jocko Homo was. So we collected all these different things. Jerry had found a book called The Beginning Was the End, How Man Came into Being Through Cannibalism. And it was a Yugoslavian anthropologist who his reasoning why all the Cro-Magnon skeletons they would find had a hole poked in their forehead was because when Homo sapiens came up from the Middle East into Europe, they were killing and eating all of the Cro-Magnon men. He said that's why human brains are so convoluted because, of course, this is 1971, he's writing this, and, Europe was still very engaged in homeopathic medicine and homeopathic, science. So it's like, to him, eating more brain would make the human brain grow bigger, but it grew too big for the skull, and it became convoluted, and it became insane and out of touch with nature. That was all his theory in this book, and it was crazy, and we loved it, I mean, to us, it was like there was something missing with both science and religion, and we felt like, well, Devo's kind of like, we're kind of like this territory in the middle where we mix it together. So, we loved those kind of books, and You Want fit into that, into that perfectly.
And so when you were with that song and the rest of the album, and you were in the studio, after the first two albums, and you had already had some, real significant success, both from a music standpoint, but culturally, for sure. And did you ever feel pressure from the record label when you're in the studio to deliver something that they felt would be successful?
Yes, of course, because, even before we were signed with Virgin in Europe and Warner's in the U.S., we had put out three singles with Stiff Records. They found these songs we had, and they found out we had a song called Be Stiff, and they loved it, and I think that was the first one they put out. So, but there are three singles they put out. It's crazy. Mongoloid went number one in France.
Great song.
Uncontrollable Urge went number one in Yugoslavia.
Another great song, by the way, theme song for Ridiculousness.
Social Fools was charted in Germany, and Satisfaction was in the top 10 in England, and Jocko Homo was in the top 40 in Scotland. And I just thought, Jocko Homo in Scotland, how good is that? In the U.S.,
that's pretty good.
In the U.S., it was like we got played on K-Rock in L.A., and we got played on college radio, DJs that were allowed to pick their music, they would work us into whatever they were playing. But, we had no, top 40 hits in the U.S. And they were kind of like, well, this is the album. You guys got to do something on this one, So we did feel a little pressure, and that hence, us saying, well, maybe there's a funk version of Devo that we could, some funk element. And I think we kind of proved that not to be true, but but it made us meet this guy Bob Margoloff, who we were interested in because he had built this crazy synthesizer with another guy, Malcolm Cecil. They had built this modular synth because they wanted to build the first polyphonic synthesizer. And this is in the 70s, you know, like early 70s. And they built this thing that looked like you were standing inside a Sputnik capsule or something, because all the walls were curved in and they had modules all up and down the walls. And the two of them each had a single monophonic keyboard, because that's all there was back then. There was no such thing as polyphonic. But if both of them each played two notes, they could play a full chord, you know. So you could get a chord sound live out of a synth. And people like they built it for Stevie Wonder, the book of what was that?
Songs in the Key of Life.
Yeah, Songs in the Key of Life. They used it for that. And then other people then, oh, we want to try that out. And so, like, the Beatles used it on something, and Dylan, and a lot of people. And a lot of black bands all got into it because it was this kind of interesting-looking, cool synth. And there's at least two album covers with different funk bands that, like, one of them, they've got kind of like, I don't know what, you'd call it, was there as close as they could get to an astronaut outfit without having access to astronaut. So, and they were pretending they were weightless, and so they're standing on one foot, leaning around, and have their hands in the air, and they're posing. And like a couple bands put it on. Yeah, so it was, but this guy, he had produced Stevie Wonder albums, and we thought, wow, that's a pretty great combo that he worked with electronics and Stevie Wonder. And so we got in touch with him, and he turned out to be, of all the outside producers we ever used, because I mean to be fair to Brian Eno and other and Bowie and other people we worked with, I was the producer and the engineer on all the songs, all the demos, and so I was always like, oh, that's what it's supposed to sound like, just but on vinyl. And I remember Eno, I read somewhere where he said, they were maybe the most difficult band I ever worked with. He said, I was pretty new to the idea of producing.
Yeah.
But they were pretty new to the idea of relinquishing, you know, artistic, you know, license to outside people that were producing them. So I didn't get to do it the way I wanted to do it, is what he said, basically.
That's pretty classic. And that was for the first album.
First one. And then the second one was a guy who had worked with Bowie and the Beatles and other people. And so by the time we got to Bob turned out, of all the producers we ever used, Bob Margoloff, he turned out to be, he had great positive energy, and he was really helpful. He taught me things that I didn't know about. And we had always had this thing where we would record a synth or a guitar or a drum, and then or we'd set it up to record, and then we'd come back the next day and you'd try to get the same sounds, and then you'd go, they don't sound the same, because there was no internal storage or memory banks on synthesizers back in the early 80s. It took a few years before that showed up. And so we'd sit there and chase our tails trying to get the bass sound that we had yesterday. Yeah. And then he showed us this thing where you would take and put a bass and a guitar or a synthesizer, all of them. You would run them each out, maybe into two different amps in the room, and then also have it on just a direct out. So you could mix those three things together. And then the next day, as you added instruments in, and it started getting better, and then it's better than the bass sound or better than the guitar sound you had yesterday. You could tweak those sounds, and I don't know, he just had all sorts of helpful hints for us, and he had a really good attitude and put up with us. We were like young, crabby old men already. So so it was like, he was like, we were so lucky that he worked with us.
So when you were finished and the music was in the can, did you know you had something special that would really break out? Did you have that kind of feeling?
You know, we we loved what we did. So we thought the first album was going to break out and be something special. And then we go, oh, people in America, they just don't get it. And then the second album, same thing. Yeah, people in America. They... And then the third album, we loved it, you know, and we really thought we had done something. We didn't put it out if we didn't think it was.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have put it out if we didn't think it was great. And Warner Brothers came over because now they're concerned because it's album three and let's see what, you know, these guys are going to come up with because maybe this is the end of it for us, you know. And they're listening and they go, oh, we like that song Girl You Want. So they wanted Girl You Want to be our single. And they put it out while we were... We stopped mixing for the recording and turned in the album, and then we immediately flew to Japan to tour. And by the time we got back, they'd figured out that Girl You Want, it went into the top, I think it went into the top 20. It might have just gone into the top 40, but it didn't go up as high as, you know, we were hoping. And so we weren't sure what was going to happen next. And then this guy, Cal Rudman, who I'd never heard of, and I don't even know who, if they have the equivalent to what he did back in the 80s now, but he would, he looked like a car salesman. He totally did not look like the guy that would be programming what kids would listen to in discos, but that's what he did. He went and pulled music from all different places, and he would build these playlists, and he started in Florida. And DJs started adding Whip It to their playlist. He thought Whip It would fit into a disco in 1980. So that's, it's like
classic.
It started going up the charts, and then it started getting played, and then it started getting radio, which we'd never had in on commercial radio in the U.S. That album became like a hit for us.
That was the journey, and I wish we could talk more about it. I'd love to talk more about it because it's fascinating. Funky Devo came out, and because of this used car salesman kind of guy in Florida,
yeah,
that was the big break, it sounds like, for the music and the album, and it took hold. And it's interesting because Girl You Want, like you said, was the first single, but it didn't rocket up the charts. Whip It was the one that really came out, but here we are 45 years later, and of course Whip It is a classic, and everybody knows that song. Every generation knows that song, but they also know Girl You Want. Like, Girl You Want has a special, iconic aspect to it as well. And then, you know, then you have another song, Uncontrollable Urge, which becomes the theme song for Ridiculousness. And that wasn't on the album, but nonetheless, it's just kind of interesting how these different pieces come into the Devo zeitgeist and into pop culture. And I want to get into some of these new, we don't even have time, but like, you have your 50 Years of De-Evolution continued tour. You have a new Netflix series, The Residence, where you were doing music for, from what I understand. You have a Devo documentary that I've actually seen, and it's amazing. So I can't wait till that comes out. You have an art gallery that you're reopening. But I want to talk about, and you have your own line of glasses, from what I understand.
Yep. Wearing them right now.
Where can we get some Mark Mothersbaugh glasses, by the way?
They're on my website, I'm pretty sure.
On the Devo website?
No, Mark Mothersbaugh website.
And that's where you have your art gallery and other art?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I'd mentioned postcard art, which is something that you started when, by the way? Like, how old were you then?
I had found out about something called mail art my first year at college, 1968. And mail art was where somebody would draw something, and this kind of happened in the 1920s, 1930s first. And it was like somebody would draw something on a card or in a letter and then put it in an envelope, but they oftentimes on cards, you know, just postcards, because it was half a penny to send them back in 1920. And they'd send it to a friend, and then they would add something or whatever, or they'd just retaliate and send their own artwork back. And yeah. In 1968, I don't even remember what magazine I was reading that I got this information from, but I found out addresses for famous artists that were involved in mail art. And I just started making up artwork on cards and sending them to, like, Andy Warhol, Robert Rauschenberg, Robert Indiana, Jim Dine, people that were lesser known, like Irene Dogmatic and Mr. Peanut and Image Bank. And you'd send stuff out to these different people. And oftentimes you got something back. And when you're like 18 and you're a nobody in Akron, Ohio, you know, that, you know, if you got run over by a car, no one would even care, you know. And I just remember getting a postcard from Robert Rauschenberg and going, oh, man, this is incredible. And so
that's
pretty
incredible.
Yeah, that is pretty cool that happened, huh? And
yeah.
So I did stuff, and I sent them out to kids, other people that went to school that I knew, other artists, and I sent them out to relatives, and I sent them out to totally unknown people, and I sent them to the president, and he didn't write. He never wrote back to me, though. I was into that mailing them out, and it's funny you brought up Uncontrollable Urge, because I used to put, after Jerry and I met, and then we were there for the Kent State shootings, and they closed our school down, so he started coming over to where I had equipment in a basement, and I was like trying to come up with music. I wanted to know what the sound of the 70s was going to be like, because I was sure rock and roll was over. So I was thinking, well, rock and roll's done. What, you know, and we've got this new thing, technology starting to happen. You know, what's the right sound for that and for our culture? Because back in the 1920s and 1930s, like the Italian futurists, I didn't mm-hmm. agree with their politics, but
yeah.
but their aesthetic was incredible, because they were like, you know, the modern orchestra, which was just like a, you know, like a typical classic orchestra now, does not have the sounds or the instruments required to properly make music for an industrial culture, which was, you know, 1925.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
they would use like, they'd put like a, you know, like a card in a bicycle wheel, and so the spokes would make it. And they'd
yeah.
add, you know, like fog horns and sirens and things. And so I said, well, what's the 1973 version of that? The 1974 version, what is that? And so I was looking for sounds on synthesizers, and I didn't like the way people like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or Yes, or, you know, especially stuff, although it was almost so bad it was good, like Captain and Tennille, like Muskrat
yes.
Love.
Which was a big hit.
Yeah, it was a big hit, but they used these little synth sounds where it sounded like muskrats making love. You know,
yeah, it was awful.
I hated it. I hated all that stuff. And I thought, well, what are the sounds? You know, because it's like I'm watching TV, and it's like they're showing pictures of Vietnam and, you know, like an American soldier being evacuated on a helicopter with one leg missing, you know, and he's laying there in pain. And then you'd see an Anison commercial where there's like a bolt of lightning going through some woman's head, and she's holding her forehead because she's got a splitting headache.
I remember like that commercial.
Yeah, and there's like a meep, and it's like it was like some sort of a ray gun sound. And I started looking at all the sounds around me, and all the sounds, you know, like a lot of them you'd get from TV, you know, like the news and from commercials, but there were just other things in the world. And I was looking for what would be the sounds you would use in a in modern music. And so I was writing all this stuff down, and I had this song. I had written Uncontrollable Urge, and I had a verse for it, and I took it to rehearsal one night. And we're all in the basement, and we're, you know, I'm singing it, and the band's doing a really great job of playing it. And I go home that night, and I was all excited about it, and I thought, I'm writing a second verse. And I wrote a second verse down. And the next morning, we all had day jobs. So I was like a maintenance man at this apartment building. So I was like ripping up carpet or something that day. But before I had to do that, I took the postcards I was mailing out to people, you know, to, you know, other artists and stuff. I posted them, and I got home after working, you know, ripping up carpets, and went to rehearsal. Bob and Jerry had a house where they had a basement that we rehearsed in, and we started working on Uncontrollable Urge again, and we were in this room that was so tiny, and we were trying to figure out what would be like a move we could do to the song, and we started doing this thing where it just went bramp, 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 where our feet just went back and forth, you know, like, I don't even know what you would say it was like, but we did it all in unison, and it made us laugh. And so I looked for the card with the second verse on it and realized I'd mailed it out to somebody. And I couldn't think of a second verse. I couldn't remember what it was. And so I ended up just starting singing the first verse twice. So, like, even to this day, Uncontrollable Urge only has one verse.
God, that's funny.
Because of that, I stopped mailing cards out. And I started going, well, wait a minute. This is kind of like... this is like an image bank for me, and it's like an idea. It's concepts and ideas, and there were pictures of Devo clothing, what I thought, if we ever get to really play in somewhere big, we're gonna look like this, I had an inflatable rubber suits where we'd have hoses hooked up to our pant legs so that like Bob Mothersbaugh could strike a chord, you know, and then his suit would inflate gigantic, so he'd look like a Fruit of the Loom, you know, like character or something, you know, inflated, and then it would go away. And we had these red hats that Bob Mothersbaugh had found a picture of them in a comic book. I think it was Little Lulu, and Tubby had a recurring theme was Tubby playing violin with a violin teacher who couldn't stand listening to Tubby play. So he wore this, one day he wore this cancellator helmet that was, you know, like, yeah, it was like a circular pyramid, and it had two ear flaps that we removed. We didn't use that in our final version. So I was putting all that kind of stuff on cards and keeping it then so that we'd have this stuff for later whenever we needed it. Like, a lot of lyrics ended up on those cards. And, you know, I'm doing these cards, and I got to, like, I had a stack of them, and I thought, well, wait a minute, these are falling all over. How do I keep them, losing them? I need to organize them. And I was enough of a nerd that when I was in high school, I collected stamps. And I knew that there was these red binders that were archival that you could buy back in 1967, 68, mm-hmm. you know, whenever. Mm-hmm. And I never bought them because I never collected envelopes, you know, first day covers or any of that stuff. I just collected stamps from different countries. But I saw these things, and I went back after I had a bunch of cards, and I bought a book for $3.80, I think, and it held 100 cards. So every time I got 100 cards, I'd buy another one of these red binders. And they still make those red binders, although I found out that the guy who makes them is 83 years old. Yeah. So I had him make a whole bunch for me because I was afraid, if he croaks, is anybody else going to make these? They won't do it. They won't make these red binders. So he made like 100 for me last year, and so I've got enough that I could go for quite a while.
Well, you showed me in the office, and it's pretty phenomenal. Those are going to need to see the light of day for sure, and because they're pretty incredible. They're pretty amazing, and it's so fascinating to hear you as an artist because for others out there, it's inspirational that you get these inspirations, these little bits and pieces from just some things that capture your fancy when you're going through a store, and something that looks a little off or just really unusual, and that captures you and you're able to make it your own. So that's pretty amazing. And you know, again, there's so many different things, but you and I previously, I interviewed you about the first artificial intelligence when it comes to music, and that was Raymond Scott's Electronium. And Raymond Scott, I just urge, we don't have time to get into it, everybody who's listening, but I interviewed Mark about the Raymond Scott, the Electronium, which, as I said, it was this remarkable piece of I'll let you describe it, Mark, but
okay.
you bought it because it meant something to you.
Oh, I don't want to tell the whole story, but I met him like a few months before he passed away. A friend of mine, he was like a pioneer in music, and not just electronic music, but before that, and just like writing kind of extreme eccentric music. His early music got re-recorded and used for Looney Tunes in the 30s, 40s. I mean, he wrote it in the 30s and then in the 40s. And then his wife only found out that he had been writing music that long ago, and that he was in all these, she knew he was in movies like Bob Hope movies, you know, like The Road to Morocco and The Road to, I forget all, The Road to Cairo and all those different movies. But she didn't know he'd written all that music until they started getting ASCAP statements, and it said Ren Snippy. And it turned out that John Crick Felucci had licensed his whole library for Ren and Stimpy. And they were like, what's a Ren and Stimpy? They didn't know what it was. And then they watched it on TV, and she goes, Raymond, when did you write that music? And he just goes, oh, a long time ago. He never even talked to her about it. And by the time I met him, he had seven strokes, and he was kind of nutty. He looked like Uncle Sam, and he'd stride around the house making proclamations, and then she'd go, oh, that means he was ready for lunch. And it'd be like 4 p.m. or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but his stuff was all getting destroyed because he had a studio behind his house. He had a spare house that was his recording studio and his music laboratory. And I went in there, and there was windows open and dirt all over reel-to-reel tapes, and there was this instrument called the Electronium that looked like an old switchboard from the 40s for telephones, and it was, in his words, it was the first instrument that wrote music by itself, and he said, and it never writes the same song twice, and the biggest claim to fame for that synthesizer, although it was a work in progress that he kept working on, was a set of albums called Soothing Sounds for Baby. And there was three discs.
That sounds very
yeah.
Devo.
You can find it. You can find Soothing Sounds for Baby out there. And it was like 0 to 6 months, 6 months to 12 months, 12 months to 18 months.
Wow.
And the first one, boop, dick, beep, boop, boop. Buck, buck. That's the music it wrote for it. Then on the second album it was pick, 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 kick, 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 pick, kick, pick, kick, pick. Then the third album was so it's crazy. I mean, he was very interesting. I helped get all his stuff saved from that room and sent to a intellectual archive for composers at the University of Missouri that has a lot of composers' intellectual properties there.
Yeah.
But they didn't want the Electronium because it weighed 1 million pounds. Well, not 1 million, but it took like 6 people just to lift it up. It was so heavy. And they didn't want it. And his wife was going to put it in the trash. And so I said, look, I'll give you some money for it. I'll take care of it for you. If something ever happens with it, we'll figure it out then. And so I've had it for a long time. And just as a side, I'm going to do something with a guy named Yuri Suzuki, who's a conceptualist, musician, artist. Who he did a computer version of the Electronium that you can buy and you can put it in your computer and it looks like what the Electronium looked like, and you can kind of, you know, like make your own Electronium music with it. And so he's coming. So I think before the end of the year, we're gonna, at my gallery I'm opening, we're gonna do a show where we'll put the Electronium and then we'll put his Electronium in it, and it'll be kind of fun.
No, that's very cool, Mark. I think that's very cool. And everybody who's listening to this, if that's, I really do urge you to look that up, Raymond Scott Electronium. And it's just a fascinating story. And Mark, just again, there's so many things I want to ask you, but before we wrap up, what you've had so many, but as an overall artist, because you play in every medium, is there anything that stands out to you from an experience, big or small, that was a truly remarkable moment for you, that was something that stays with you? I know that's a big question, but anything that just really impactful for you?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's like, that's the kind of, you could ask me that question every day for the next year and I'd have a different, something different, you know?
Yeah.
But, okay, the first album, what I really liked was finding out decades later, when I looked at the 2-inch master tapes that we recorded in Germany for the Are We Not Men We Are Devo, Eno and Bowie record, I looked at that and I looked at the track lists and there were all these charts because there weren't, you couldn't pre-record things back then, so you couldn't save things. It didn't have memory and since, so I had to write down all my settings on, and I made these big ugly charts that I, and they were saved with the albums. But then also there were charts of the track lists that Eno had written in this beautiful handwriting. He had incredible calligraphy and beautiful handwriting, and he meticulously wrote down all the EQ settings and everything. But then I'm looking, there's tracks, I'm going, what's that? And it says, David Bowie, Brian Eno, vocal track.
Wow.
David Bowie, guitar track. Brian Eno, synth track on different things. And I'm like, wait a minute. And I remembered that I was like, he would put up a mix and we'd all go, okay, that's the mix. But I would, while we're all staring straight ahead at the two speakers, you know, because, you know, it's stereo, so we're all staring there. And he hits the record button for the quarter-inch tape that's going to be the master tape. I would reach up and without looking down at him, I'd pull the fader slowly down for the tracks that had stuff in it that Devo ourselves hadn't recorded. And I just remember I could see in my peripheral vision, I could see him go, psst, his head would snap sideways and he'd be staring at me like, what the fuck? You know? And he didn't know how to say it.
What the fuck?
Yeah. He didn't know how to say to me, wait a minute, Mark, why did you do that? I thought we all agreed, you know, and he just kind of let it go. And so I always, after I saw those tracks, I just always thought, what would be the chances I could give him those master tapes back and he would mix it the way he wanted to mix it? I just always thought, what would it sound like? It might be a lot better. Who knows?
Is classic. You know, just the stories that you have, Mark, you know, we could talk forever. I do want to have one final question. Just what does Mark Mothersbaugh listen to? So what's on your playlist these days?
You know, it depends on what's got my attention at the time. And sometimes it's bands and sometimes it's soundtracks and sometimes it's music from other places. And it depends on what I'm working on. Like I just did this show called The Residence and the music
for Netflix, right?
For Netflix, yeah. And the music is like 5 or 6 bebop players for most of the music. And I loved working with those guys because they it's like interesting because jazz players, like rock players, you put down A, E sharp on a piece of paper, F minor. And you show how many before the next chord change. And classic players, you know, that play in an orchestra, you give them like this pieces of paper that look like it's covered with like fly shit or something. It's thousands of little notes. And they look at it and, you know, the downbeat happens. They play it perfectly the first time or the second time. Because sometimes the first time, then you have to make a couple changes. And these people are great at that. But, like, those people, you ask them, hey, it's a Wes Anderson movie. Can you, when Owen Wilson comes over the hill, can you just do a little flute frill for that? And they just look at you like deer's in Headlights, you know, or something, because they don't know how to improv. That part of their brain is different than the part that the rock and roll people have, where they where you can say something and then they're comfortable with that, kind of directions. And jazz people have both sides of their brains, so they're the funnest to work with, because you send them this paper and they play your track, but then I could say, okay, well, the detective's coming around a corner and she's going to see a dead body, and the drummer would go, oh, can I do a little, and he'll make something up, and then the bass player will like have something he wants to do, or the piano, and so it was really delightful to get to work with them again.
Well, that's very cool, Mark. Listen, I really enjoyed this. I enjoyed the conversation. I always enjoy speaking with you. And you are the ultimate conceptualist and Renaissance man when it comes to art. And it's fascinating. No, it's true. I'm not saying that you truly are a conceptualist. And to hear just the way that you think and how these little these moments of inspiration lead to your work is great. And I really urge everybody to check out all the different forms of media that you play in, because it's Devo, of course, 50 years does continue this year, 45 years since Girl You Want and the great Freedom of Choice album. But there's so much more to the repertoire that you do. So, Mark, thanks for your time, your generous time today. I really enjoyed it.
Check out Mutt-Muzz Gallery. I'm going to open it up in a couple of weeks. And it's just like a hipster gallery. It's not like a, you know, like anything other than that. But it's in Chungking Road, so it could be fun.
Okay, outstanding. In Los Angeles, everybody, on Chungking Road. And it's Gallery Mutt-Muzz?
Mutt-Muzz Gallery.
Okay, Mutt-Muzz Gallery, and that's your gallery.
That's the gallery. Yeah, it's Mutato Musica Contracted.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Mark. Really good to see you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo, one of rock's most iconic bands of all time, sharing his story behind their magical, masterful, and manic track, Girl You Want, from the 1980 album Freedom of Choice. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media. You can find me at deepcutsmedia.com. If you like the story behind the song, which I hope you do, please rate my podcast, follow it, and share it with your friends, family, and other music fans like you. New and classic episodes come to you every Monday morning. And make sure you're following the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
Stuck in a job you hate? Wish you could break into tech, but don't know where to start? CBG Nuggets makes IT training simple, affordable, and dare we say, fun. With short, engaging videos and hands-on virtual labs, you can build real-world skills right from your browser. No expensive hardware, no confusing software. Just practical training that gets you job ready. Learn at your own pace, on your own schedule, from anywhere. Start your 7-day free trial at cbtnuggets.com. Because a better career is just a few clicks away.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.